questions on anything? So at this point, you should have a good idea of what your grade is. There in purple at the bottom is everything. So three exams, all the homework, all the lab stuff. For the just the labs, if you look at the top, almost everyone has full credit for the three night labs at 60 points each, and then the home labs are worth 90 points each, 60 for just the observation and 30 for the calculations. It's the best. So lots of you have questions about how your grade's going to work out. What do I need to get on the final to get grade X? The best way to do that is just to email. So I'm happy to answer questions like, what do I need to get on the final in order to get grade X? So drop me some email and I'll happily respond. If you want to do it yourself, that's also fine. You have all the data you need. The cut points were on the original sheet, but probably just as happy to have me calculate it as calculate it yourself. So there are two more things that add up to your final grade. By far, the hugest is the final, which counts, roughly a third of your final grade. And so presumably we're going to schedule a help session for that. I don't know if any of you have conflicts, but if there are conflicts, I'm happy to have an alternative time to the Thursday 6 p.m. time that people can take it. And the other thing we've got is the post-test. So you took that test at the beginning. You can take it at the end. Really would like you to take it, but I mean the facts are it's not going to change anything. There are something like 787 homework and quiz lab points. So this is, I think, 20 or 30 or something like that. So might change things by a half a percent or something like that. But it would be good if you take it anyway. So help, study day, what time? Tuesday study day. Anybody have a favorite time?
4 o'clock.
Sounds like 4 o'clock is the only suggested time. That's a bad time. Okay, so we'll say 4 o'clock here. Tuesday. Alternative test times. Is there an interest in that? Not yet. So I guess we've got one more class period if you discover problems to schedule something. You can, whatever people want, I'm happy to vote on it. Suggest a day and a time. Oh, in the day, earlier in the day. You were saying? So I hear Thursday at 9 and Wednesday at 2. Is that what you said? Other suggestions? How does deciding between those two? Yeah, but so it's good. Everyone can show up at Thursday at 6, but sometimes a handful of people for various reasons want to do it at a different time. And I'm willing to do it at a different time, but not 20 different times. What do you say? So I hear a slight preference for Wednesday at 2-ish. So if large numbers of you are going to show up, you should tell me, because I can't probably schedule a room for that time, so what we'll probably do is do it in one of the labs downstairs. So if... Say again? Oh. It doesn't... So are large numbers of you going to come to Wednesday at 2? We're large number... Who's going to come to Wednesday at 2? You're not committing yourself strongly. So a good number of people are going to come. I think we'll be okay. The labs are pretty big. So come one, come all, I guess, to the alternative time at Wednesday at 2. Show up at my office downstairs. Almost certainly, I'll check to see whether a class is scheduled for this room, but chances are pretty good that something else is scheduled for this room at that time. Other questions? Okay, so we've done just about everything. So we were starting to take a shot at biology. And astronomy and biology have common sections these days. There's a National Center for Astrobiology that's out at Washington, looking for life on other solar systems is very high gain possibility, but I would say kind of a low probability sort of event. But I guess before we started to talk about biology, we kind of finished up some things about the sun, namely kind of a review of how we actually measure the properties of the sun. And so we get the distance to the sun by as direct method as possible. You can time bouncing radar signals off planets in the sun to get really accurate distances to these guys. The size of the sun. Well, sun doesn't literally have a hard radius, so there's some range of variation, but what we can do is see the angular size. It's about half a degree in size, and if we know the distance, then we can use basic high school geometry using the angle and side to get the diameter of the sun. The mass, you remember that if we have moons, as it were, that are going around a central object, we can use Kepler's third law to calculate the mass of the thing in the center. We've got 8 or 9 planets plus lots of asteroids to tell us the mass of the sun. So we can think about the sun as being a light bulb with some wattage. How do we get that wattage? Well, we can calculate how much energy is going through a square meter here at the Earth, and if we know the distance to the sun, we can see how many square meters there are that it would take to fully surround the sun, and we can calculate the luminosity of the sun. How long does it take the sun to rotate? It's about a month. Sunspots are the traditional way of doing that. That leads to differential rotation. Helioseismometry allows us to actually see what's going on at the inside, and the sun does rotate as a rigid body once you get inside the convection layer. Surface temperature, roughly 6,000 degrees. Remember, we can get those temperatures by looking at the peak wavelength in the spectra that's produced by the surface. Composition, we look for absorption lines in the sun. It takes a little bit of correction to do that because some common species, like hydrogen and particularly helium, don't leave much of a mark in the spectra. So you have to kind of extrapolate that this tiny line implies that there are huge numbers of hydrogen atoms. And it took a good bit of time to figure that out. It wasn't until 1920 that people realized that stars were mostly hydrogen and helium. Helioseismometry, that's how we figure out what the insides are. The run of temperature and density accurate to 1%. We've got that for the sun. The insides of the sun are really better studied than the insides of the Earth. Age, we use meteorites for that, right? Basically 4.5 billion years. Okay, so then we kind of started biology. Take a look at where biology was at circa 1860. And I think it's worth saying again that biology is really different from the other kind of named sciences that so there's an American Physical Society, the American Association, the American Astronomical Society, American Geological Society, but there isn't an American Biology Society. The biology really is a huge area, and there are lots of sub-disciplines to them. So we kind of look at 1860, actually, there's A good bit of work was done in that decade on areas that became kind of central to biology. So certainly one of the most important tenets of biology is the idea of natural selection. So Darwin argued based on human selection, artificial selection, that if you select for a particular type of cat for a few hundred generations, you can take small variations and build up to big changes. And in some sense, evolution is a tautology, that is to say something that's true basically by definition. All it's saying is that only the surviving children can reproduce, and that the characteristics of those children have something to do with the probability that they reproduce. So instead of having humans select what cats are going to have a future generation, nature is constantly doing that for us. It's choosing the characteristics that are highly likely to produce children. And there really isn't any doubt or controversy about any of that stuff. You may think that there's controversy about evolution, but there really isn't much, because it's automatic, right? Only surviving children can actually reproduce. So if there is going to be controversy about evolution, maybe a few things are worth talking about. You pretty much have to agree with what's sometimes called microevolution. You can look at the history of cats, you can look at the history of bugs. There's no doubt that if you act on 100 generations, you can make noticeable changes. But no one has changed a cat into a dog. So some people argue that while evolution works on the micro scale, it can't actually make different species. The other quibble that people would have with Darwin, and the Pope would have this quibble, has to do with random selection, right? So the Pope would tell you that the evolution of humankind isn't a result of random selection, it's a result of the intentional design of a creator. But other than those, I would say relatively minor points, you can't argue with the idea that only surviving children can reproduce. So the mechanism of this natural selection was not clear to Darwin. It was clear to Darwin that characteristics don't kind of average out, right? You don't have men and women producing something halfway in between. But exactly how that occurred and the mathematics of how that occurred, even though it had been worked out by Mendel, was not known to Darwin. Mendel's work was kind of pushed under the rug, and it was forgotten until about 1900. But he had all the details right, that these characteristics are randomly assorted rather than being a blend of parents. Working typically, so he was a monk that was working with, as commonly said, pea plants. So Pasteur, name should be famous to you from pasteurization, did lots of important things, founded microbiology. Koch, somebody who was kind of the co-founder of microbiology, germ theory, and the realization that microbes really are almost everything. Very important components in the big circle of life, as it were. But in any case, for us, heretofore people had speculated that you could have life form from non-life, that flies would spontaneously form out of nothing inside meat that was rotting. And Pasteur showed that was not, in fact, happening. Now, if you work back forever, it's a little bit problematic. Was there ever a time when there was spontaneous generation? And this is what Darwin had to say about it in a letter, I think it was 1871, which suggests that while if we had interesting biological molecules around now, they'd be gobbled up by somebody. But before there was anybody around to gobble them up, conceivably they might come together to form something that is a cell. And people have worked hard to see if this is the case. And what is certainly the case is you can't do this in 5 years, you can't do this in a graduate student's lifetime. But Miller and Urey did a famous experiment that showed you can go moderately far. You can go from very simple building blocks like methane and ammonia, carbon dioxide, and add some lightning and some heat, and you can get the run of biological molecules that we're about to start with. And so speculation is that if you ran the experiment for 50 million years or 100 million years, you know, maybe something would crawl out of the flask. Some microbe, not some frog. There are lots of problems with that. And I guess we'll take a look at what some of those problems are in a second. Okay, so this is kind of where things were a century and a half ago. So then we started talking about biological molecules, sometimes called organic molecules. So we have some familiarity with what these things look like. So here are fatty acids. We've got long chains of CNH. This one here, every carbon has four appropriate bonds, and every carbon bond here is associated with the appropriate number of hydrogens. Here we have double bonds. So this guy is unsaturated. It doesn't have the maximum amount of hydrogen in it. And this guy is polyunsaturated because it's got multiple occasions of double bonds. So long gasoline-like sort of molecules are what's involved in fats. So we've got carbohydrates and sugars. So sugars by themselves are combinations of carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen. Again, understand the notation here. Each one of these things that come together in four jots is supposed to be a carbon atom. So here we have six carbons in a ring. Here we have five carbons in a ring. Under some conditions, these rings open up, so we get linear molecules of glucose and fructose. We can put these guys together by kind of removing a water molecule and make big chains of carbohydrates. Incidentally, we get combinations of fats kind of automatically. Typically, fats have a side that loves to live in water, like this carboxylic acid group, and a side that likes to live in highly saturated material, so-called nonpolar material. And so fats will kind of automatically orient in a layer that has water on one side and CH stuff on the other side. And this kind of automatic organization of fats is kind of the basis for how cell membranes work. So you can see down there at the bottom, one of the key features here of all of this is putting pieces together. That's the hard part of biology. So we've got amino acids and proteins. So amino acids have an amino group. That's this NH2. You should think kind of ammonia, slightly basic behavior. And they've got a carboxylic acid group, C double bond OCOH. It's acid because this hydrogen is liable to fall off. And this amino group is called basic because another hydrogen can at least temporarily join those groups. So things that lose hydrogen atoms are acids. Things that gain hydrogen atoms are, generally speaking, bases. And once again, what we can do is we can put these things together. We can take one of these H's and this OH, and we can take them out, and we can make this linkage and string together large numbers of amino acids to make proteins. And most of the machinery that's inside a cell is made out of these sorts of proteins. There are a limited number of amino acids that are naturally present, and the information content that's required is in this molecule that's known as DNA. It consists, so that's deoxyribonucleic acid. It's kind of a spiral staircase where we have these rungs. Is that still upside down? Yeah. Okay. So what we have here are sugars, deoxyribose or ribose, put together with phosphate groups. So these form the the outer strands, and the information content is stored in what are called bases, which are not strongly bonded together, but have these somewhat weak so-called hydrogen bonds that put them together. And these things have a natural togetherness. That is to say that C is always going to go with G, and A is always going to go with T. And triplets of these bases define how the cell will eventually make a particular amino acid. So there's a triplet so RNA is different, right, in that it doesn't have, it's got the uracil instead of the cytosine? No, we got cytosine. Thymine, I guess. So we got a triplet code that codes for a particular amino acid. And at least approximately speaking, the linear sequence of these triplet codes then determines the linear sequence of what's going to be linked together in order to make your protein. And you build your engines that way by these set of blueprints. So the kind of puzzling feature from a origins point of view is kind of how can we get life to form, since nucleic acids require proteins and proteins require nucleic acids, and it's kind of a chicken and egg sort of situation in order to have the very first life. Okay, so I sure hope you already know these names, Watson and Crick, famous for discovering the chemical structure, this double helix structure of DNA. Slightly less well known are the work. So Watson was a molecular biologist, Crick was a physicist, and Franklin was a chemist. And in some sense, Franklin did the heavy lifting. She's the one who actually took the X-ray pictures that were required in order to figure out the structure of the molecule. So you needed to grow a crystal and then use X-ray diffraction in order to figure out what the ordering of the structure is on the inside. And it's not a simple process to go from an X-ray diffraction picture to the actual three-dimensional structure. So Watson and Crick literally stole their pictures and creeped into her lab at night, stole their pictures, and then made some models that fit. Franklin died before she could win the Nobel Prize along with Watson and Crick. Oh, so the process of going from nucleic acid to a protein is called translation, and it happens on a little machine that's called a ribosome. So the ribosome, kind of like a tape recorder, takes in this tape of a sequence of triplets of base pairs, and it reads it and links together the appropriate amino acids to make the appropriate protein. And the process is a little bit weird, and it may tell us something about the origin of life. So the way this works is that we don't have a direct relationship between DNA, which holds the information, and protein, which embodies the information. Instead, what happens is the DNA is transcribed into RNA, right? So remember, the difference is whether we've got deoxyribose or ribose as the sugar on the backbone. And also this difference in the steps. And then that RNA is translated into protein using this machine that is the ribosome. So the other key point there has to do with this word polymers. So we've seen for all of these biological molecules, they come together. They're kind of organized bricks in order to make more complicated structures. And that's kind of a problem for entropy. So remember, we said that Gibbs free energy, circa 1880 American physicist, one of the first prominent American physicists, named for this quantity, which shows that there's kind of a balancing act between entropy and energy. If the temperature is low enough, then things always go to lower and lower energy. But if the temperature is high enough, then having disorder, remember entropy is disorder, having disorder is worth paying some energy to do. So at high temperature, atoms break apart. They ionize, increasing the disorder, but it costs energy to make them ionize. But nevertheless, the payment you get from having increased disorder is worth the price you have to pay in terms of energy. So polymers are, by definition, organized structures. So they're going to have a decrease in entropy, not an increase in entropy. And so how you get these things to actually link together is a little bit tricky. If the temperature is low enough, you could just rely on the lowest energy state. But at moderate temperatures, entropy is always going to want to break apart your ordered structure. Questions? Well, what can we learn about the evolution of life on Earth by looking at it, you know, kind of geologically, as it were? That is to say, let's go back and see, you know, what fossils occur when, and maybe we can work our way back to the beginning. So if we If we look back through the history, the existence of things like mammals are literally just the tiniest tip on the history. And we really start to get the first sort of big sort of structures about half a billion years ago. So here's where we get this explosion of life forms that starts with things in the ocean. The land was not suitable at this time for occupation. There wasn't an ozone layer, for example, so the surface would be exposed to ultraviolet light. And what we've got is this much bigger history of the Earth. And it turns out that life occurred, as far as we can figure out, pretty early on in the history of the Earth. So the earliest possible life forms you can imagine that have been in rock that's been around for 4 billion years, there's always a good degree of ambiguity about whether this is a bubble or a microbe. But there's various pretty good chemical evidence for the existence to life pretty soon after the Earth was in a state that you could have life, where it wasn't liquid rock as opposed to having oceans and such. So there's a huge period of time. The vast majority of the history of time of life on Earth is a history of just microorganisms, presumably just things like bacteria. Things that are as complicated as a yeast cell, which have the extra complication of having a nucleus, so-called eukaryotes, that also seems to be a relatively recent idea. So the idea is that apparently, just based on how long it took to do, making bacteria, making very simple life forms that are just biological machines, turns out to be relatively easy. But making more complicated structures, for example, making nucleated cells that have organelles, that have substructures in them, seems to be a more difficult process. And best guess is that this happened by kind of symbiosis, that the nucleus of a yeast cell, for example, came about by having two things come together, two microbes come together, one of which being the body of the cell and the other one becoming the nucleus, and other ones becoming other organelles like the mitochondria and the chloroplasts. So here we're still at the range of just single cells, but more complicated single cells that are in some sense combinations of the other microorganisms. And we have to wait a good bit of time before we get really multicellular creatures. And then we pretty quickly go through a sequence of pretty impressive creatures. Okay. So if you work your way back in the tree of life, this is kind of the picture that you get. So first of all, how do you go about doing this? Well, you look for characteristics that these guys have in common and the characteristics that they have in difference. And I hope the main thing to take away from this is again the idea that microorganisms, you know, which is everything except that, are most of the story. Just the small tip of the iceberg are these more complicated creatures. And if we go back, all we're talking about is, of course, microorganisms. And exactly how these three branches work together is less than perfectly clear. So in this particular guess as to how to put together the tree of life, we have bacteria as being the source, but it could also be these kind of, these are all microorganisms, so maybe you would call all of these equally good bacteria, but these little dots are distinctly different from those little dots. So what are the sort of differences that we're talking about? Okay, so we've said that the eukaryotes, they've got organelles, they've got substructures inside of the cells. Whereas bacteria and archaea, they really don't have quite the same sort of complicated structure that we've got on the inside. So, I don't know, we could go through all of this stuff, all these seemingly slight differences. I don't know if it's worth going through each one of these in detail. But you can see that there are lots of differences between, lots of differences and similarities between these different groups. So back when I was in high school, it was kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. But now on top of all of that, it's domains. So we've got three big domains. And then here in Eukarya, we can have our kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species of subdivisions. Okay, so, I don't know. Small stuff at the beginning, maybe no particular surprise. But I don't know that this really gets us to the true origins. I mean, what we still have is an incredibly complicated machine here at the beginning. A machine that is still running on DNA, on this central dogma, DNA, RNA, through the action of ribosomes being converted to proteins. The particular type of ribosome that we have in the different branches is different, highly related, but these ribosomes are slightly bigger than these ribosomes. But nonetheless, a pretty complicated machine, as far as we can say, evolves after a few hundred million years of having a solid surface on the Earth. So there's a lot of speculation about how we can solve this kind of chicken and egg problem. And maybe the one I'll mention, none of these things are in any sense well verified, is an idea that goes under the name of the RNA world. So RNA doesn't seem like a necessary step. So maybe the existence of RNA is a clue as to how the very early organisms might have worked. And one of the main things we need out of proteins are what are called enzymes, chemical catalysts, things that allow chemical reactions to occur that otherwise would occur at incredibly low rates. So linking together these sugars to make a disaccharide, you can mix glucose and fructose in water and it's not going to happen. So having some sort of catalyst that allows things to get linked together is absolutely key. And pretty much, I'm about to give you an exception, pretty much every known enzyme is based on protein. Pretty much all of the structure inside living creatures is based on protein. But somewhat recently, what they found is that some strands of RNA can act as catalysts. So the speculation is, well, the evidence is that RNA can do both things itself. It can act as a catalyst and it can store information. So if you're going to pick one of these guys to be the original biological molecule, RNA seems like the best bet. There are lots of problems with that. So what we would be talking about then is an organism that basically just had RNA that was doing all of the jobs that all of these things are doing today. There are problems with that in that ribose itself is a relatively hard molecule to have spontaneously form from these throw together the junk and let it cook for 5 years sort of experiments. Okay, so at least for me, the main lesson from this process is that it looks as if life is pretty easy to form if you're talking about microbial life. That happens fast, hundreds of millions of years between when you could have a suitable environment and when you have microscopic life. But doing more complicated things seems to be ever more complicated. But once you reach a certain spot, once you actually get multicellular life, difference between the Precambrian and the Cambrian, that's when things seem to kind of take off, and in relatively brief fashion. So the time separation between us and the dinosaurs is small change compared to the time separation between these early microscopic lives and the first eukaryotes, things like yeast cells. So making multicellular life is certainly a lot more difficult than making microscopic life. Microscopic life seems to be a pretty simple thing to do. Okay, so we started by trying to answer the question, what's the chance that there are other creatures out there, that there are aliens? And the Drake equation is sometimes presented as an attempt to make some sort of estimate of how many critters are out there just waiting to talk to us. And I would say that, you know, it has this name equation, so maybe it sounds like it's slightly more legitimate. It's really an argument. It's nothing like science. It's an argument that has a point, and Drake's personal point was that he believed that life was out there and that it was worth trying to communicate with it. So what's this mechanism? So the basic idea of the Drake equation is there a sequence of steps that are required in order to have life. And let's try and estimate the probability for each one of those events individually and then link them together to get the overall probability of finding life in the universe. And this is nothing but making fancy the idea that if there are billions of stars, that it's not unlikely that there's going to be life. The kind of twist in the Drake equation is that the claim is that by measuring the existence of life, we can find out something that may be of interest to us. That is to say, how long are there going to be people on this planet? What's the lifetime of technological civilizations? So the Drake equation claims to tell us that by looking for other alien civilizations, we can get a clue as to how long our civilization will last. So as I repeat, it's an argument, not science, but I think it's kind of an interesting argument. So let's kind of link together all of the things that are required in order to have life. So we're certainly going to be interested in the fraction of stars that have solar systems. These things traditionally have different names. Okay, so we'll let FP be the fraction of stars that actually have planets. Now, when Drake wrote down his equation, there's absolutely no data on this. And any number that Drake considered for the, and in fact, that's generally going to be the case. Lots of these numbers are things that even today, we don't have a, it's a matter of opinion. You get to put your own number in. But some of these now have some basis in fact. And while we don't know the precise ratio of planets, of stars that have planets, it's pretty high. Lots of stars have planets. It turns out getting an unbiased sample is a little bit tricky, and that's something that the Kepler satellite hopes to do in another couple of years. But this is a reasonably big number, and a half is certainly not an unreasonable guess for the commonness of planets. So given that you've got planets, how many of those planets have the possibility of having life? So if you're too close to the sun, it's going to be too hot to have liquid water. If you're too far from the sun, it's going to be too cold to have liquid water. And at least life on the Earth is highly connected with water. So sometimes we talk about a habitable zone. It's the region around a star where it looks like you could have liquid water. And talking about life is possible, I mean, is, right, who knows how what sort of weird forms life could have. And these days, this goes under the name of habitable zone, and it's pretty well linked to liquid. Typically, people have a hard time, we have one example of life, and it requires water. And any other sort of possibility of life is going to sound like speculation. I don't know. So for example, Star Trek occasionally has, so if you look at the periodic table, we have carbon-based life, and you know that the periodic table shows chemical elements that have similar properties. So kind of the next best guess is let's go one slot down below carbon and see what other element has properties similar to carbon. And the answer is silicon. So on Star Trek, they occasionally have silicon-based life forms. But it turns out that that's really difficult to make work. So one of the special things about carbon is that the strength of carbon-carbon bonds is comparable to the strengths of carbon-oxygen bonds and carbon-hydrogen bonds. So you can get lots of combinations and permutations. Whereas with silicon, the strength of a silicon-silicon bond is way less than the strength of a silicon-oxygen bond. So that silicon oxide is pretty much what you would end up with in silicon. So in any case, these days, anything that's not carbon-based and water-based is, well, it has no basis in fact, right? We only have one example of life, and that version of life is carbon and water-based. Incidentally, that in itself is kind of a surprising feature that maybe needs to be discussed a little bit. If we have all of these ponds that potentially could produce life sprinkled all over the planet, why do we only have one critter that survived all of that in order to found all of our types of life? That is to say, why aren't there separate branches of life that are based on other ponds? And best guess is that the first critter ate up all the molecules. The first guy who could actually eat all of these interesting biological molecules to get energy did so, and became the only survivor. So on Earth, on this solar system, one or maybe one and a half if you want to count Mars. I mean, Venus is kind of a special case. I mean, if it didn't have that huge greenhouse effect, maybe there could have been life. So as I say, you can pick your own numbers for these things. So let's let FL be the fraction of planets which could have life and do have life. Okay, so there's absolutely no data on this, right? We can't count ourselves as an example, because if we weren't alive, we wouldn't count in the first place, right? So typically people are going to put, though, a pretty high number for this too, kind of based on that time argument. It doesn't look like life is tricky. It looks like life happens fast. So I would root for a pretty good number for the fraction that have life, that do have life. And although finding a microbe on another planet would be super interesting, we're really interested in intelligent life. And here I think you're free to put in as small a number as you want. So if you just base it on time, you know, you can pick your favorite age for when Neanderthal man was intelligent, but I don't know, 2 million years, something like that. Life was around for basically 4 billion years. So, I don't know, a part in 1,000, a part in 10,000, those are easy numbers to convince yourself. And again, you can't really take our planet as an example. I mean, maybe this is zero. So the fraction of intelligent life that actually builds radio telescopes, builds radio systems, builds something that we could communicate with at a distance. It doesn't have to be a radio telescope. Any sort of broadcast radio is going to go to infinity and has a chance to be detected. Now again, if you take kind of a time basis for this, right? So radio is kind of the last century and intelligent life is the last 1 million years, part in 10,000. You can have a pretty small number for that if you want. But maybe all intelligent life eventually wants to build radio telescopes. So maybe that number should be 1. So then we get kind of the piece of the puzzle that I think Drake was wanting to push forward as a reason for doing this research, and that's the lifetime of technological civilizations. So Drake was writing in the 60s, and of course there was big concern in the 60s that we were going to blow ourselves up and that we might not be around a century from now. And of course, similar ideas involve global warming today. Maybe technological civilizations kill themselves kind of automatically after a given period of time. It would be nice to know. So this is the number that Drake was trying to convince people was worth knowing, whether technological civilizations are doomed to die or whether they're not doomed to die. And the missing piece, which is actually the first piece, how many stars are born per year? How many chances do we get per year? How many roll of the dice do we get per year in order to start this process going? And this is one of the numbers that you can have some experimental data on. You can look for new star formation. And not all stars are equally good. So big stars don't last very long themselves. And really, any star that's bigger than the sun has problems in terms of its overall lifetime. The sun will live 10 billion years, but if we had a star that weighed twice as much, it would only live about 1 billion years. So probably don't want to consider stars that have a mass more than twice the mass of the sun, but lower mass stars are fine. So what's the rate of star formation currently in our galaxy? And kind of a minimum possible number is 1 star per year. It could easily be 10 stars per year, but it probably can't be 100 stars per year. So the plan is to put all of these things together and get a handle on what the expected lifetime of a technological civilization is. Okay, so, oh no, we don't have to call it quits. Yeah, we're good to go. So how many communicating civilizations are there in the universe? Well, if, and this was kind of, crudely speaking, this was kind of Drake's argument, is that if all those numbers are one, then the number of communicating civilizations in our galaxy is equal to the lifetime of a communicating civilization. So if there's only one, then on average, they only last about 1 year. If we think that technological civilizations can last for 10,000 years, then there should be 10,000 of them in the galaxy. If we think that technological civilizations can live for 1 million years, then there should be 1 million of them in the galaxy. Now, if you put smaller numbers in here, of course, you get smaller results. But the idea is that we can get a handle on how long technological civilization will last by going out and observing. Do we get radio waves from this star, that star, the next star? Are those guys out there? So that's kind of the plan for SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And it pretty much, Drake was a radio astronomer. So the plan is pretty much to use radio telescopes. And he himself, I think, looked at 10 stars in the early 60s, which of course is all small change, but it's hard to get radio telescope time on something that has such a poor plan as this one. Well, he actually had his own radio telescope. He was in Ohio, but it was a pretty lousy radio telescope. So we've got bigger and better radio telescopes. Remember, the biggest one is, well, so we've got radio interferometers like in Chiraco, New Mexico. They're, in some sense, they're not ideal. We said that the interferometers are particularly good for resolution because they simulate a big radio telescope. But if we're trying to look for dim radio signals, what we really want is a lot of collecting area. So these guys only have so much collecting area. So it might have 10 times as much collecting area as a single dish radio telescope, but a big one would be better. So you remember in Puerto Rico, we have this valley that has been filled with radio telescopes. That was kind of the opening scene for Contact, which is one of the speculations for all of this. But, I don't know, something like 1980, 1990, Congress decided that it didn't want to spend any money on search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So, and government is the source of most funding for astronomy. So they cut off funds for using it, and what happened was that one of the Microsoft millionaires started to fund a huge array of really small but cheap radio telescopes. So basically recycled television antennas, big dish television antennas, not as big as the one we've got out there, but not that big. A dish of those guys, a square kilometer of those sorts of dishes to look for intelligent life. And it's not exactly a simple thing to do, right? Because you don't know what station to tune in. Radio spectra is a huge range of possible frequencies, so what you have to do is to monitor all of them for a good period of time in order to convince yourself that it's time to move on to the next sort of star. So multi-channel analyzers are a big part of this plan. So get as much dish antenna as you can get. Monitor as many frequencies as you can get. And look for unusual signals. So in the 70s, a lot of hearts were beating fast because they found a sequence of perfectly timed pulses coming from a particular location in the sky. And when I mean perfectly timed pulses, I mean better than any clock on Earth, better than atomic clocks. These pulses came extremely regularly. And for a little while, they were talking about LGMs, which they internally, but not publicly, said stood for little green men, being the source of these things. But it is a natural phenomenon, it turns out. These are what are called pulsars, and they are rotating radio sources. So just as the Earth's rotation rate is extremely regular, you can think about a pulsar as being something that has a natural source of radio light, and as it spins around, that radio source, kind of like a lighthouse, points at the Earth and then doesn't point at the Earth. And we get these extremely regular pulses. So pulsars don't look like they're extraterrestrial intelligence. Just looks like they're natural phenomena. But that's the sort of thing that people would look for, some sort of regular pattern in the radio signals from a source, and probably at not a wide range of frequencies. It's one of the tip-offs that pulsars aren't intelligence. They broadcast on a whole range of frequencies simultaneously, whereas our radio signals are, of course, at a frequency for lots of good reasons. So what are the brightest sources on Earth? That is to say, if we imagine the reverse problem, if we think about what somebody on Alpha Centauri would see if they, you know, were listening to the Earth, what's the brightest thing on Earth? And it's not television, it's not radio, it's ballistic missile search radar, right? So we're always worried that the Russians are going to attack, so always we're shining radar pulses into the black sky, and they turn out to be the brightest things on Earth. And that kind of begs a question about the future of all of this. So in 1960, the future of broadcast in general looks good, but if you look at kind of the future for the Earth, it's slowly going dark, right? So increasingly, instead of picking up your television by aerials, you pick it up by cable. And cable, of course, doesn't go to the stars. And if we ever had peace on Earth, maybe that's an unlikely situation, you wouldn't need those radars searching the sky. So instead of the end of radio being the end of the technological situation, maybe it's just the end of radio. People go to cable. Broadcast kind of makes no sense when you think about it, right? You're spending all of your money to send this radio signal 360 degrees, spreading it out over the black sky as opposed to putting it to individual paying customers. So as an economic model, it's hard to see how broadcast is going to last. And if the planet goes dark, then you're not going to detect intelligent life. So, I mean, you would have heard about it if it had happened, right? So far, these searches for interesting radio signals from space have failed. I think that something like 10,000 stars have been carefully examined, and it's not entirely clear that it's worth looking a lot beyond that. We're kind of at the 100 light year distance. So obviously you deal with the close ones first because they'll be brighter. And because if you actually want to communicate with a conversation, it's got to be two-way. So if you think about something that's 100 light years off, right, we say hello, and 2 centuries later they say hi, it's kind of a slow process. Really, kind of the early hope was that The aliens would be so friendly that they would be constantly broadcasting the contents of their encyclopedias to space. None of that has been seen yet, of course. So people have worked hard. We're getting out to pretty reasonable distances at this point, pretty large numbers of stars, looked at as well as we can at a whole range of frequencies, and nothing yet. So it's not looking good for looking for intelligent life through radio signals, and really the hope was that intelligent signals would be intelligent and therefore be made a lot easier to detect. So what we do in broadcast is we put a fair amount of energy into just one frequency, which means that that frequency is particularly bright in terms of a spectra and it stands out. The other sorts of signals that we would look at would be natural signals, and they might be a lot harder to detect. But these days, I think that's what people think is the way of the future, that is to say, the way that we're most likely to detect life. And I think that in your lifetime, and probably in my lifetime, you will hear credible evidence on the news saying that this spot, this point of light in the sky, we have detected life. And this is going to come in the context of exoplanets. So a minority of you thought that there might be life in our solar system. And I won't, as I say, my overall point of view with those votes, who knows, right? And it's certainly worth looking for. I would say particularly on Mars because it's the best bet. The other cases mostly have to do with drilling through 100 kilometers of ice, which I don't see how we're going to do anytime soon. But looking harder on Mars is certainly a reasonable thing to do. And in particular, digging a little bit deeper to get to areas that haven't been exposed to ultraviolet light. But if we don't find it in the solar system, and I'm personally not betting it's going to happen, the next best place is to look at at this point, more than 1,000 planets that have been discovered that aren't part of our solar system, that are going around other stars. So, I mean, obviously, if we picked up radio signals from those things, we'd be all set. And I don't know that for a fact. I would bet that the SETI Institute has very carefully looked at every star that has a known planet around it, in part because they tend to be close. And the people who do exoplanet searches for various reasons have also looked at mostly at stars that are candidates. Stars like Sirius aren't really good candidates. You're looking for stars that have a lower mass than the sun. And those are also the ones that the exoplanets people look at for other reasons. So how could we detect life if there isn't anybody talking to us? And in particular, we'd like to deal with the more likely types. So, you know, these things here, I was arguing you're fair to assign pretty low probabilities if you want. But I really think you got to assign a pretty high probability to the fraction that could have life that do have life. Again, based on this data, that it looks like life happened really quickly after the situation became possible. So for exoplanets, the majority, well, it's changing as we speak. I think probably it's still true that the majority of exoplanets are discovered by the planet pushing the star around. Right, so you remember that there are no unmoved movers. Jupiter is going to push the sun just as the sun pushes Jupiter. And so the sun will have these slight Doppler shifts as it moves towards and away from the changing position of Jupiter. And that's a very sensitive method to detect exoplanets, has a relatively high probability of success, particularly for big planets that are close to the star. But those are exactly the sort of planets that we don't think are particularly good choices for life, right? If you're close to the star, it's probably too hot. So we'd like to find planets that, you know, take a year to go around the star, because those are the ones that are more likely to be in the habitable zone. And just seeing the push or pull of the star isn't going to tell us whether there's life. So somehow or other, if we're going to detect life, we're going to need spectra from the planet. And that's tough, of course, because planets are small change compared to stars. So a million times the light from the planet is what the star is going to be producing. So somehow we have to separate out the very small contribution of light from the planet from the bulk of the light that's from the star. And maybe it's worth reminding you that there's just no way, well, that's somewhat, I could be proved wrong easily. There's really no way we're ever going to have a picture that shows a dot that is the star and a dot that is the planet, particularly for a planet like the Earth that is moderately close and a moderately small planet. We're always going to have one big fuzzy dot that includes the light from everything in that general direction. We just don't have the resolution in order to resolve separate planets. And so the best bet is cases where we have eclipsing planets. So I'm changing my picture. This is now the surface of a star, and we're imagining that the planet moves right in front of that star. So now we can have the light from the star before the planet goes in front of it, and the light from the star when the planet goes in front of it. So by looking at the difference between those two things, we can get the light that is just going through the circle that is the very thin circle that is the atmosphere that's surrounding the planet. So with a lot of hard work, we should be able to get the spectra of the atmosphere of eclipsing planets. And it should seem to you as a pretty unlikely event. Only a very small fraction of planets will be eclipsing as viewed from Earth, but that's exactly what the Kepler is designed to find. It's designed to find the very small fraction of planets by monitoring literally a million stars in the constellation Cygnus to look for things that are moving in front of it. And we know that the spectra of Earth is different from the spectra of every planet that doesn't have life, right? Because it's got oxygen and ozone, these sorts of compounds that don't occur naturally, that require life in order to be produced. So if we see oxygen's a highly reactive gas. If you kill the life, the oxygen on Earth would disappear in a few million years. Methane is also a fairly reactive gas that would disappear naturally over time. So if we see the spectral absorption lines from those sorts of guys, we've got good evidence that there is at least microscopic life on those planets. And I think the probabilities are pretty good that that's going to happen in 10 or 20 years. Okay, so we'll start it up next time.